I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. And we are also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are novelist Jacqueline Michard and literary agents Elizabeth Pomata and Michael Larson. First up is Jacqueline Michard. Jackie Michard was a journalist and widowed mother of four when she wrote her first novel, The Deep End of the Ocean, which became the first selection of Oprah Winfrey's book club and an international bestseller. She has since written three more best-selling novels, The Most Wanted, A Theory of Relativity, and most recently, 12 Times Blessed. She continues to write her weekly newspaper column, The Rest of Us, which has appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for more than 19 years and is national syndicated by Tribune Media. She lives outside of Madison, Wisconsin with her husband and children, and her latest book is Christmas Present, published by HarperCollins. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
Oh, Christmas Present. What an emotional book.
It is a bit of a ride.
It is a bit of a ride, right from the start, just about from the start. Will you talk about what inspired this book?
Actually, an acquaintance of an acquaintance of mine had something like this happen to her, and I couldn't remember exactly who it was, but all stories, I guess, start with a question, and for me, the question that all stories start with is, what if? What if this circumstance were to happen? How would you handle it? How would you cope? How would you respond? And then I put characters into those situations and see how they try to get themselves out of trouble, or how they try to find some saving grace in a difficult situation.
Hmm. Is that pretty much how all of your books begin, with what if?
What if? Mm-hmm. Right. What if this happened? The deep end of the ocean. What if a child was lost to his parents and then they didn't discover what had happened to him for 12 years? It wasn't so much the story about losing the child as what would happen if later on they found out. Who would these people be?
Yes. And they'd
be different people.
Hmm. Your books tend to be very emotional. The Deep End of the Ocean, I recall that being quite an emotional read as well. How are you able to do that? I mean, you have children, you have a lot going on, and for me, it's writing about something that could possibly happen to me is kind of a scary thing. Apparently not for you, because you're able to do this quite successfully.
No, it's very scary. Today I had a bad headache, and I had I thought, oh no. For those people who don't know what the book is about, it starts with a woman who's on her 14th anniversary, has gone to an Italian restaurant with her husband, and is leaving the Cirque du Soleil, and gets a crushing headache, which quickly they discover is something more serious than a headache. It's an aneurysm in her brain. And I often write about things that are terribly draining to write about. And it's almost like after having done it, after having spent some time with the characters in the book, it's like having swum a very long way and climbing up onto the beach wet and drained. And I've also found that sometimes putting those ideas out in the universe does make them, I'm sure it doesn't have anything to do with it, but they seem to happen. For example, in The Most Wanted, I was a widow then and had dated, I think, every orthodontist in southern Wisconsin. And at that time, I gave up. I said, there's just no one who thinks that a woman in her early 40s with four children under the age of 12 is the dream date of the 90s. And I just gave up on the idea of that. And I made up in my book the husband I would want. And I met him the day the book was printed, the day it arrived. And how eerily like Charlie Wilder he was astonishing to both of us.
That's interesting. That's.
I certainly hope. I mean, my agent says that I should make up a book about a woman and her agent who win the Irish sweepstakes. I certainly hope that what happens in Christmas Present isn't something that's going to happen to me. However, there is a certain grace in Laura's way of handling her ultimate night on earth, or what may be her ultimate night on earth.
Yeah. Interesting. Will you read to us?
I'd like to, yeah.
Okay. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and Jacqueline Michard is about to read from Christmas Present.
Okay. It is the night before Christmas Eve, and Laura Banner's in the hospital with what has been diagnosed as a ruptured aneurysm in her brain. And she may or may not survive, and her three daughters have just been brought to the hospital by her mother. She speaks first, she'll be speaking first to her middle daughter, who's 8 years old. Oh, Rory, Rory, morning glory, sun queen of the valence beam. This is so terrible. If I had $1 million, I would give it away. If you just didn't have to see me like this. You don't have $1 million, and you don't look sick, Mommy, Rory said. But I am, honey, Laura said. It's inside. Like cancer? Sort of, but no, Laura sighed, thinking she was possibly the only person in the entire United States tonight who actually wished she did have cancer. Hand me the sticky paper, will you? Laura asked Rory. Coat moisturizer for dog all gone. Heartworm pills, too. Cleaning to be picked up at Cantor Eating. Save one of my rings for each of the girls. My grandmother's for Annie. Find daycare provider in-home. The impossibility of compressing an entire lifetime of routines and assumptions, just so instinctive they were like swallowing, was like describing the color orange to a person blind from birth. Would you like to talk to each of you talk to me alone or all together? She finally asked her daughters. "Well, if it matters at all to anyone," said her eldest, Annie, who was 13, "I want to talk to you without them." Laura looked her up and down and was heartsick to see that Annie had chosen to wear a skirt and blouse and French braided her hair, rehearsing for a funeral, she thought. "Well, that's okay. Well, sit down beside me." "I don't want to," Annie said, curling her lip. "Well, I don't smell or have anything catching," Laura snapped. "I mean, I would obviously cry." "Oh, and that wouldn't get anything cleared up? Do we have things to clear up?" "Yes, a couple," Annie said. She's made her own list, Laura thought, blinking furiously, pretending to fluff her pillow. "To begin with, I was the one who stole the $20. I'm sorry I called you a bitch in the letter, which was from me. I'm going to have my period soon. I smoked a cigarette at Justine's. I bit Amelia just last night because she hit me with her lousy makeup bag, and I have a huge welt on my head." "Well, I know all those things," Laura replied, trying to keep her voice even. "Not that you bit Amelia. That's a little over the top. But it shows you're a good person that you wanted to tell me. As for your period, well, just use my things." I don't mean your things. I mean you won't be there with me." "Nice," Annie hissed. "Do you think I picked this time to die?" "Well, how can someone who does 200 crunches a day die in 8 hours? "I'm not doing it voluntarily," Laura said. Annie's rage was fearsome. "Thanks a lot. I suppose now I have to be a big grown-up like you were when your father died, because Dad's going to be a big, limp psycho, and I'm going to have to take care of Rory and the baby and totally have no life of my own. Can't you think of us?" "I wish I could." "Anna, please, you have every right to be angry with me, but I wish you wouldn't do it now because you'll hate that you did it later, and it'll make you feel lousy." "Which brings me to another thing," Annie said. Laura wished she had a watch. She feared Annie was using up her allotted time. Everyone had to have a piece of time. There were each of Laura's siblings and Elliot's and her mother's. And finally she said, "Well, I want to change my name and have my name be after you. Anna Laura? I don't think it goes together." "No, Annie Laurie. I happen to know that's what you wanted to name me, but Dad wanted to name me after that stupid old song by Al Cooper, and you gave in like you always do." "Well, you can do that. You can start by changing your school papers. You don't even have to go to court. Because that was my baby song, you know," Annie said, standing up, her sturdy frame a pillar of rage. "You sang it to me. For love of Annie Laurie, I would lay me down and die. You remember that, my darling?" "Yes, I remember," Annie said, and stalked out of the room shouting, "Next!"
That's it. Gee, thank you. That was Jackie Michaud reading from Christmas Present, just published by HarperCollins. How do you turn it off? How do you turn off the emotion of that you're caught up in writing when you're done writing for the day? Or do
very
you?
Very hard. Sometimes when I'm finishing a book, I wrote this book when I was doing research in another country for a book that I probably won't write for several years. And the rest of the family was away for the day, and it was sort of, I didn't intend to write it. It was sort of a short story that got out of hand. And I certainly didn't intend to publish a Christmas novella, because I think that that's sort of a little gimmick now that well-known writers kind of do these little stocking stuffer books. But when it turned out to be that, I was glad that at least it, I hope, it's about some of the things. I called it Christmas Present with a comma because there is sort of a ghost in it. And there was another writer 100 and some years ago who was told that if he wrote a book that was sad and had ghosts in it at Christmas time, no one would ever read it. But he did okay. And I wanted it to be about the things that we think about at whatever sort of tradition we embrace, that we think about at certain times of year, about what we keep, what we leave behind in the time we spend together on Earth.
Yeah. It sounds like you follow the story or you follow the characters by how you're speaking about this book, that you were writing a short story and it became a novella.
Right. I tend to be long-winded, and there didn't seem to be enough to... there didn't seem to be enough time in the context of a short story to tell about the interrelationships between these people who were brought together on this particular night in one place because of a crisis that was visited on the one of them that holds all the others together.
So it became
more and more complex because there were lots of different relationships and lots of different histories. And yet it's a very simple story, like Laura's life. She says at one point that she's had a very small life. And her doctor says to her, but you have, it's been an examined life. You've lived it. I mean, regardless, so it's been a full life. You've lived all of it.
Yeah. Do you outline or plot?
I do. I plot just the way you plot your papers in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I make outlines. I try to divide my books up into chapters and more or less say that what's going to be in each of the chapters, and then I decide on a given day when I'm writing fiction, when I'm not writing journalism. I'll try to write up into the point where her mother enters the hospital, or up to the point where Elliot finds the birthday presents behind the boiler, and then I'll stop. And I always stop at a point where I know there'll be a place. I don't stop when I'm finished with something. I always stop before I'm finished, so there'll be something to come back to.
Yeah, interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Today I'm with Jacqueline Michard, author of Christmas Present, published by HarperCollins. Are you aware of the marketplace when you're writing? Are you thinking, you know, how can I make this commercial, saleable, what's selling right now? Are any of those thoughts in your mind as you're writing? Or
no, because I have no idea. what's selling right now seems to be so evanescent, even in the years, which is really a short time for a novel writer. I've written 5 novels and a book of essays and then some children's books in 8 years. And even in that 8 years, the kinds of things that people are reading have changed so much. The whole phenomenon of sort of fashionista books, someone said to me one time, why didn't you have this be a book about 4 blonde women who were models who were all wanting to spend Christmas Eve with the same married man? it's just getting a story in my mind and being unable to get it out of my mind. I was obsessed with this story, and I couldn't remember who had told me the similar story that took place in real life. The details are very different. And I finally remembered who it was when she read it. I quickly dedicated the book to her.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you're a journalist as well as a novelist, and I'm curious about the carryover from journalism to fiction. Is there any for you?
There are so few of us left anymore. I think that Carl Hiaasen and a few others still write a weekly newspaper column, and it's the same motion, but the difference is between accompanying yourself on the guitar and singing a folk song, as opposed to conducting the orchestra and making sure that you know the woodwinds come in at the right time and the timpani comes in at the right time. And so you're sort of controlling a universe instead of a room.
Hmm.
And so one is neither is more meaningful than the other to me. One is just more complex and requires you to have your attention and your hands on many different parts of a web.
Yes. That's a good way of explaining it. Most journalists that I know, once they publish fiction, many just stop with the journalism, stop with the columns.
Almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because fiction is so consuming. It's such a difficult thing to do, and it's so consuming that I wonder sometimes myself how I have enough life in me to produce both of those kinds of things. And yet, the one feeds the other. The writing I do about what happens in the real world, not in the imagined world that I create, is a different sort of discipline than fiction writing, and it keeps me grounded in the way that other people say teaching keeps them grounded.
Mm-hmm.
I can't teach writing. I never learned it. I never learned it in the accepted way. I mean, I didn't go to school for it or go to school to be a fiction writer. I didn't long always to be a fiction writer. Now I long to remain one as long as I can.
How did it happen?
Well, I was so gobsmacked, if you will. I was so knocked over by my husband's death. He was very young, and he died really brutally quickly, not like Laura Banner, but over a period of a couple of months. And, you know, it's not an accident. And, of course, like Tennessee Williams, you know, said, you don't know what your book is about until after it's published. And you read the reviews. I'm not sure that I wasn't on some level thinking about how it must have been for Dan to have to tell his children, who his sons and daughter, who were aged then 15, 9, 6, and 3, that he was not going to live to be an old man. I suppose that there's a time when I need to write about something that's extremely current and happening right now in the real world that I care passionately about, and the column is an outlet for that. And then there are things that are eternal. I mean, novels, at least the novels that I think I like to write, which are more old-fashioned than some novels. They don't have a lot of references to different kinds of popular culture. Those are things that last and that are common ground for everyone, or at least I hope they are.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Oh, dear. And we have a few minutes left. This is going too quickly. I wanted to ask you if with your first novel or with your fiction in general, if you write it as if no one will ever read it, if you're conscious of your audience, or, you know, if you're writing what you need to write because it needs to be written.
No, I'm absolutely conscious of my audience. I don't think a book, you know, Joni Mitchell once said, when people accused her of becoming popular, as if that, you know, people always say to me, when I go to a literary residence or when I teach at a literary conference, they say, well, I'm a literary writer. And I say, well, that's wonderful. And they say, by that I mean I'm not a popular writer, as if those two things are mutually exclusive and as if it's somehow you can't use beautiful language and spell things correctly and still have more than, you know, 10 people read your work. And Joni Mitchell said once, art risen art if only 14 other people know about it. So, and I think the same, it's not really a book until someone else reads it.
Mm-hmm.
The dance is not completed until the reader takes your hand. And otherwise, it's just something that you've done for yourself and you've looked at on your own and hung in the window to see how it catches the sun, but it's the reader who really brings it to life. So I'm very conscious of the effect of the words that I write on a potential reader out there somewhere tonight reading it.
Yeah. Jackie, any advice, any words of wisdom for the writers listening who may be struggling through a story or a novel unpublished?
Well, I think that sometimes you can spend too much time on it. You can revise and revise and reform and reshape something to the point that you've got the skein so tangled that you can never find your way out again. I think it's important to remember what I consider truly great writers knew. Nell Harper and Truman Capote and Willa Cather, which is to be simple. Read things that are written simply and well. Mark Twain said, "No book worth its salt would be ununderstandable to an intelligent 13-year-old." And I believe that. I don't think that books... I don't subscribe to the very popular theory, modern theory, that a sentence has to be so convoluted and complicated and weighted with metaphor and complexity that it has to be read again and again in order for the reader to understand it. I don't think that's a gift to the reader. So I would say read, and when you read, remember to be simple.
Hmm.
And if you find yourself being carried away by the beauty of your own prose, remind yourself to be simple.
Yes. Oh, good words. And thank you.
Thank you very much.
For taking the time.
All righty. Good night.
Good night. That was Jacqueline Michard, author of Christmas Present, published by HarperCollins. And she was speaking to us from Madison, Wisconsin. Next up after the break are literary agents Elizabeth Pamada and Michael Larson. Please stay tuned. And welcome back to Writers on Writing here at the University of California, Irvine campus. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I was just on with Jacqueline Michard, and I'm back with Elizabeth Pamada and Michael Larson, San Francisco literary agents who worked for six major New York publishers before moving to San Francisco. They started their agency in 1972. They have sold books to more than 100 publishers. Elizabeth and Michael have also reviewed books for the San Francisco Chronicle and created publicity outlets and now Metro California Media. They also collaborate on the Painted Ladies series and are now pleased to present the Painted Ladies website. Michael is author of Guerrilla Marketing for Writers, How to Write a Book Proposal, and is a contributor to the new anthology, The ASJA Guide to Freelance Writing. Hello, Elizabeth and Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to have you on.
Thanks for asking us.
Oh, sure. I was talking with an author friend of mine today who just feels that the whole fiction market is just so depressing and flat, and I wonder if both of you could comment on that and tell us what you foresee.
Well, I disagree that it is depressing and flat. I know it is difficult. It's probably harder now than before, but at the same time, there are more opportunities for novelists. They can be published in trade paperback and be new young voices, and many publishers are starting whole lines of new young American voices, literary or commercial. The people, even mass market houses, are now doing chick lit first novels that could have been called mid-list novels because they're simply about young girls having a good time in the big city or wearing Prada or trading up. But this is a whole new genre, opening up lines of communication and fiction and for young people as well as older people who like to have fun.
The reality is that because of the consolidation of the industry, there are six conglomerates now that dominate the industry, four of them foreign-owned. They're less interested in developing new writers than they used to be. At the same time, there's more options for getting books published than ever, online and offline. So I think certainly a trend will be that writers will more writers will start off with new, small presses, rather. More new writers will start off with small presses or university presses, or will self-publish their books to test market them.
Interesting.
But one thing you have to remember is that one of the reasons many, if not most, people in publishing go into publishing is that they love books. And most of us, many of us, love novels. That's the reason we're in publishing. And so we're all looking out for good new voices wherever we can find them.
Hmm. Talk about what you do look for. What knocks you out when it comes in and you just say, yeah, we have to get this one?
Well, something new, of course, with a new voice, a new idea, a new take on the same old boy meets girl, girl meets boy. A new something that's out of the ordinary. It can't just be the same old coming of age or the same I've left New York, went to the West, found my life, and started all over again. It's got to be new and fresh. It all has to have pace, whether it's literary or commercial. It still has to have some kind of driving force. It has to have characters that I want to spend time with. I don't want to read or handle books that have characters that I would not let in the front door. That's important. So that may be very old-fashioned, but that's me. And it has to have something to say.
There's also the one-page test. Elizabeth once brilliantly said that a novel begins when I can't put it down.
Hmm.
In the age of computers and MTV, it's a mistake, huge mistake, to keep people waiting to be entertained. I think the first page of a story, first page of a novel has to be exciting. The acronym I've come up with is SOS, style or story. One of them has to be compelling on page one. Memoirs of a Geisha, for instance, is a beautifully written book. Page one, there's not a lot of action, but the writing draws you into it immediately.
Hmm.
It doesn't have to be plot, but it's got to be one of the two.
Yes. Well, what about nonfiction?
Well,
again, it has to be new ideas and new voices and have something new to say.
You're talking about what knocks us out, right?
Yeah.
I think a metaphor that can be helpful to writers is the notion of new wine in a new bottle. Ideally, the information is new. It's a fresh idea. And it's conceptualized in a compelling way, so it makes it clear there's a fresh new idea. The reality is that most books aren't about new ideas so much as a continuation of books about marketing or sports or cooking. Fields have already been covered. But that makes the bottle, it's all the more crucial the bottle be new, that it be conceptualized in a fresh way that's going to convince editors that it'll survive all the competition that's already out there and will continue to be out there.
Yes.
But promotion and writing are the other two things. Ideas, promotion, and writing. Promotion's crucial for service nonfiction.
Hmm. Now, will you talk a bit about the different ways authors or would-be authors would ideally contact you for fiction and nonfiction?
Well, we have a website.
Do you want to give that address?
Sure. It's www.larsenpomada.com. That's LARSEN, P as in Peter, O M as in Mary, A, D as in David, A.com. And people contact us by email. They write letters, queries, or simply follow the directions on the website.
There's a lot of helpful information on the site for writers, and get a good response to it. Whether or not we can help a writer, there's a lot of information there that we'll find helpful.
Yeah. Do you tend to be or see yourselves as more sort of lifetime agents or per-project agents?
Oh, definitely lifetime.
Uh-huh.
We're not interested in one-night stands. We really want someone who's building a career and wants to make a commitment to that career and wants us to be part of it.
There are many reasons why I think now is the best time ever to be a writer. But for nonfiction writers and for novelists as well, really, I think there's more potential than ever for writers to practice niche craft. Come up with an idea that lends itself to a series of books that they will enjoy writing and promoting, and building a career, book by book, talk by talk, city by city. And there are A to Z, Sue Grafton. I mean, she's created a way to write a series of novels. Janet Ivanovich, her series really could be infinite. I mean, it's based on numbers.
Yeah.
So I think that's a tremendous opportunity. It makes create synergy between everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that if anyone can help make me laugh out loud the way Janet Ivanovich does, they've got me hooked.
Interesting.
An editor also once sent to us, if it makes me cry, I'll buy it. Sitting behind the desk, wanting to get excited.
Yeah.
And editors buy the next thing that they read.
Mm-hmm. Well, do clients tend to find you by referrals or by sending in queries, by meeting you at a conference? I mean, or do they just come all sorts of ways?
All sorts of ways. There are times when editors sent in publishing houses send us authors. There are times when we sit down on the plane and the person next door on the plane is an author. Michael once got a book from a taxi driver in New York. We have strangers send us things all the time because of the email and our website. Friends send us things.
We're in directory.
Send us stuff.
The reality is that, I mean, we've been at it for 3 decades now, and we've also, between us, written or co-authored 14 books. So we're sort of, you know, people sort of know about us, and as they say, we're in directories. You know, it's easier than ever to find a literary agent. I mean, you could just Google it, and you'll get all kinds of links. The challenge is getting agents to say yes, and since, you know, agents in general can only make a living by selling books to big publishers, that's a challenge.
Yes. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here with Elizabeth Pamada and Michael Larson. They are literary agents in San Francisco. In terms of finding an agent, how important is personality, the way your personality meshes with their personality or theirs with yours? How important is that, say, from a writer's point of view to be vigilant of, and how important is it for you?
Well, I think it's very important. We have a California philosophy that is we only handle books that we like by writers we like and only sell them to editors that we like.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that an author has to figure out what it is they want in an agent. Do they want a nurturer? Do they want a shark? Do they want a friend? Do they want someone who lunches all the time? Do they want someone who's a rainmaker who can get them article assignments? Or do they just want someone who makes sure that everything goes smoothly?
The best metaphor I've heard for the relationship between a writer and an agent or an editor is that it's a working marriage that's got personal and professional aspects to it, which is why I always recommend that writers meet with agents or editors who want to handle their work with them before then, so they can test that kind of chemistry, exactly the word you used, see what that relationship will be like, get a feeling for it. And as in all things, they've got to trust their instincts and their common sense.
Hmm.
That's one of the ways that writers' conferences help. You can end up meeting a lot of agents and seeing how they work and how they interact with people.
Yeah.
And Michael and I do go to lots of conferences all over the country, including the ASJ, one in New York. And in fact, we're even starting a writers' conference here in San Francisco.
Yeah, talk about that.
Well, it's the very first one in San Francisco, the first San Francisco writers' conference. It has a theme of building bridges to better tomorrows. It's going to be President's Day weekend, February 13, 14, 15, in 2004, at the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, which is right on Union Square in San Francisco.
Yes.
We have about 35 speakers lined up, and 8 to 10 editors will be there, and over 25 agents.
Hmm. Wow.
And that's more agents than at any other conference. And one of the things they were doing is an idea I came up with, which is a lot of fun. It's writers who come will pay a $25 extra fee if they wish and get a chance to have one-on-one, 3-minute consultations with as many agents as they want.
Hmm.
It's fun. It's enjoyable for the agents and for the writers.
It's three hours of madness. But
you
end up meeting tons of people.
Yeah.
And actually, you get, you know, you see face-to-face, the agents have fun, the authors have fun, and even, believe it or not, 3 minutes is enough.
How can listeners find out more?
we have a website for that too.
All right.
It's www.sanfranciscowritersconference.com.
And San Francisco is spelled out?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Interesting. So agents must be coming from out of town.
Oh, sure. Los Angeles, New York, Connecticut.
Excellent.
And the Bay Area.
I mean, the reality is there's like about 25 agents in the Bay Area, so a strong community.
Mm-hmm. Agents are a very esoteric type of creature for most writers. You know, you only seem to come in contact with them when you're shopping for an agent. You rarely run into them, and you're very, very exotic creatures. You know.
Well, that's because we read all night. We don't have time to get out of the house.
I mean, in the New York area, it's certainly more likely to happen because there's such a concentration of them there. But and I think people can learn and get some kind of idea about agents and publishing if they're in New York. But outside of that area, yeah, writers tend to need a perspective about writing and agenting and publishing, which is one of the things that agents give them.
How should writers interpret rejection? You know, there are form rejection letters, and then there are rejection letters that might say a few words like, oh, it's a crowded shelf, or it's just not right for me. You know, there's a few different phrases that a lot of agents use, similar phrases that agents use. And often writers are trying to read between the lines in terms of, well, crowded shelf, what does that mean? Does it mean...
All means thank you, but no thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to say throw away your typewriter.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if they want to get the work done as fast as they can do it, and simply just say thank you, but no thank you. If someone takes pen to hand and writes a few words, that's really a good thing. And if someone writes you a whole complete note about why they're sending it back, then that's gold. That rarely happens.
It's our rejection letters on our website, and as far as I know, it's the kindest one in publishing. People think in terms of good prose and bad prose, but to my mind, that's not the fundamental distinction. I think the distinction is between writing that works or writing that doesn't work. Danielle Steele and Amy Tan write very, very differently, but their readers love them.
Mm-hmm.
Both writing well enough to interest and keep their readers reading. So I think the way to look at writing is either it works for its potential audience or it doesn't.
Yeah.
Another reason why now is the best time ever to be a writer is that there's more models to follow than ever. You don't have to figure out what a mystery is or what a sports book is. It's out there.
Mm-hmm.
So just pick models, both authors and books, and do what they do differently and better.
Yeah. Well, what about earlier, Michael, you mentioned conglomerates. There's many publishing companies, but they belong to very few corporations, and so it must cut down on, say, when a book goes to auction, the amount of players that can come to the table.
That's true.
Or, you know, does it affect advances? I mean, what is conglomeration of all these publishing companies doing to publishing?
Making publishing into more of a business than it ever was. That we used to moan that publishing was not a well run as a business was. Now that it is business first, we, of course, wish for the old days.
Yeah.
But it's true that there are only maybe six big houses, and in three of them at least, you can't bid one part of the house against another part of the house. In another, with Random House, for example, people can bid against each other as long as there's a third party outside the house bidding.
Hmm.
But when you say they're not really bidding against themselves because they're all different, they all have different, they're small publishers within the big publisher.
Sure.
Dell versus Ballantyne and Broadway and Knopf and Vintage.
Bertelsmann has 70 imprints.
Hmm.
So, and you can approach as many of them as you want about it. But when it comes to bidding, then distinctions arise.
Hmm. Do you think it's made a big or has affected that whole process extremely? I mean, you know, especially the auction, the process of bringing a book to auction.
Well, I think that there's a plus and a minus. Yes, there are fewer places to send if you're going to do an auction, and it can be more difficult. But at the same time, because people don't want to be in auctions, they do much more preemptive bidding. So people can get a manuscript, and if they open it that day and like it, they can be making an offer the next day.
Yeah.
We've heard of an editor who got a manuscript at 9 in the morning, and by 11 it had already been preempted, mm-hmm. 2 hours later, mm-hmm. before he even had a chance to look at it.
Yeah.
Something hot that tends to move quickly.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with San Francisco literary agents Elizabeth Pamada and Michael Larson. So publishers don't particularly like auctions. They'd rather just, you know.
They don't like them. They quite often, the nature of it is that they're forced to spend more money than they want to.
Uh-huh.
They gamble millions every year on books that don't earn out. That's
right.
The way of it.
And also, it takes more time.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much easier to say, I want this book.
Mm-hmm.
X, take it off the table. I want it. If it's good enough price, the agent and the author will say yes.
Huh. It's interesting.
You know, there aren't that many books that happens to. It tends to get all the publicity and it arouses people's expectations. The reality is that well over 90% of the books publishers buy, they spend, even big houses, spend $25,000 or less on them.
Mm-hmm.
90% of deals are not big deals. They're more than 90.
Hmm.
So, and books tend to be big or little.
Yes. We hear a lot about platform these days with nonfiction writers. What do you have to say about platform? How important is it, and does it matter when it comes to fiction?
It's the fiction answer is shorter, so I'll go first. More and more, it is getting to matter that a novelist have a platform, or at least know how to build one, and get started immediately doing promotion, being part of groups, doing websites.
Short stories.
Getting short stories published if mm-hmm. they're literary novelists. They do have to be known if they want expect to get out there. And websites are probably the easiest and fastest way to do that. But promotion is very important. With nonfiction,
yeah.
It's really key.
If somebody's doing a how-to book for a wide national audience, or any kind of book for a wide national audience, the promotion of which has to be author-driven, big houses will expect authors to already have national platforms, a national platform, that is, continuing national visibility, either through the media or through the far more common way of just giving talks around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's crucial. What most publishers do for promotion, they do around the time of publication. Books have generally a 1 to 3 month launch window. And if they don't generate enough sales momentum by the end of that period, publishers go on to the next book. They're doing hundreds a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crucial that an author be able to create maximum amount of promotional impact during that launch window and be able to keep giving talks about it and traveling for as long as they want it to sell.
Yeah. What about regional audiences? How much does that weigh in if an author has a regional, you know, is in a city and has a regional platform?
Unless it's New York, it doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a platform in Cincinnati.
Aww.
Even small publishers now don't want regional books because they still have salesmen that go out and sell all over the country.
Yeah.
So the regional market is really dissolving. That's where self-publishing comes in.
I mean, if it's a series book, then that can be a factor. Elizabeth is the author of a book called Fun Places to Go with Children in Northern California. And this year, the 9th edition of it came out on its 30th anniversary. But Chronicle has a series of books, Place to Go with Children, in Northern California, Southern California, different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
The regional books can work that way on quite a small level.
It would not sell today if I wanted to do a proposal for that book.
Right.
They'd say, no, you have to either have a series or we're not doing it.
Yeah, well, there's still regional travel publishers, certainly regional travel books, but in general, yeah.
What about if, say, you're in San Francisco and you are, you're a speaker, you're a motivational speaker, and your book isn't limited to San Francisco, but your audience is. And I guess that's sort of regional audience as well. I mean, would that matter, where your book is really applicable to anybody, anywhere, but you have a website in San Francisco. You have speaking engagements all over the place. You teach at, one of the universities in the area. What about something like that, having that sort of regional audience as opposed to national?
But if you teach all over the place, then you teach all over the country. You should have a national platform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it starts with goals there. Agents and publishers can only help writers get where they want to go, but only writers can decide where that is.
Uh-huh.
How many talks can a writer give without burning out a year?
Right.
How many copies of their books do they want to sell? Agents and publishers don't make any money on the talks writers give or on the profits they make from selling books, which is where most of the profits from books should be, talks and back-of-the-room sales, not royalties.
Yes.
So that's a particular model of publishing, right? It's John Gray, it's Deepak Chopra, it's the Chicken Soup guys.
Mm-hmm.
Either that makes sense for a particular author, a particular book, or it doesn't. If it doesn't, that's fine. And you just want to think about another way to achieve your goals. Be clear about what your goals are, literary and financial, and then figure out the best way to achieve them.
Mm-hmm. We're at the end of our time. I wonder if you both would offer any last words or advice for the writers listening.
If writers are writing to meet the needs of the marketplace and they can promote their work, now is the best time ever, far and away. It's more subjects to write about, more options for getting books written, getting help with them, more ways to promote books and make money from them than ever before. And Adler used to give this advice to writers. He used to say that if anything can stop you from becoming a writer, let it. If nothing can stop you, do it.
Right.
Make it.
Yes.
And I always say, and make sure you have fun while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're here.
Mm.
Gotta love the work.
Yes, you definitely have to love the work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ernest Gaines has what he calls the 6 golden rules of writing, and they are read, 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 and write, write, write.
That's good.
Yeah. So,
thank you. Will you give your website again?
Our website is www.larsenpomada.com.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you for asking.
For coming on. You're quite welcome.
Thanks.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that was Elizabeth Pomada and Michael Larsen speaking to us from San Francisco. They are literary agents there, have been for 30 years, and handle fiction and nonfiction. And they gave you their website. You can also find them in the writer's resource book, such as Literary Agents and Writer's Market and those sorts of books, the literary marketplace that the library has. In any case, we're at the end of our time once again. And if you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, go to my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Walter Mosley, who said, "The act of writing is a kind of guerrilla warfare. There is no vacation, no leave, no relief." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. Hope to see you here next week.